8:18 now. Good morning. This is the local news hour on KPCW. Well, the Park City Planning Commission meets tomorrow night starting at 5:30 in the City Council Chambers. In the studio with details, I have Interim Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson along with Planner McKenna Hawley. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, Bruce, what's your status? We're supposed to hear some announcement this week about your future.
Well, I still spell interim the same way. People are talking. I'm pretty enthusiastic about the team that I work with. And we're chatting, and we're going to wait till the city manager makes some decisions.
All right. So let's talk a little bit just quickly about how the staff's doing. I mean, we've lost several planners just in the last year. Katie Kattan, Thomas Eddington, Kayla Sins, most recently Christy Alexander. Are you fully staffed?
No, we're short a couple of people. And one of the challenges we've set for ourselves is trying to decide exactly what and who we want to fill the slots. The last departure, Christy Alexander, actually got one of the top jobs in our profession by going to the city of San Francisco to become a planner. And as much as I hated to lose her, that's a highly respected role, and we're very, very proud of her.
All right. And then the work that she was doing then, I mean, you just assign it to somebody else?
Yeah, all of us take little different responsibilities, and you know, our team is really stepping up, especially the folks that have just come on in the last year and a half, like John Bame and McKenna Hawley, who we have here with us today.
All right. So is this turnaround part of the problem that we've seen with making mistakes like 205 Main Street?
There's a lot of pressure on the team right now, and it is one of the only professions that has a 7,000-person set of eyes on everything. That is the population of the town. And so what I tell our folks is, when I took over as interim planning director, I got a book of 500 pages of rules and 25 years of perceived mistakes. So that's the baggage we carry every day. There is a lot of pressure on the staff. The home building pressure is on us, the planning department, and the building department. And so, it's pressure-filled business.
Yeah. So in terms of, I mean, what gets done, you know, we haven't seen any action really with Treasurer. Are we just waiting for the applicants to move forward with that?
The negotiations with Treasurer are moving forward. They're kind of in the background right now. The applicant is trying to make some decisions about what wants to be resubmitted. The city is making some decisions about the development agreement and exactly what's permitted up there, trying to make sure they know exactly what's going on.
So it's on hold at this point until that gets resolved?
Yes. Well, both sides are talking, but you won't see anything in the public until everybody kind of makes sure they know where they stand.
All right. I introduced her, McKenna Hawley. You've relatively a new full-time planner, but you've been with the planning department for a couple of years?
I've been with the planning department for just over a year and a half now, and I'm a planner tech.
Okay. So what does that mean?
Well, it means that she's at the entry level of planning. As you move through the progression, she came on as an analyst, and she's been promoted to a planner technician, which means she handles plan reviews. She's learning conditional use permit process. And we're just bringing her up through how we do things, and she participates really well in trying to plan our future.
Okay. So let's see. On the agenda, we have another public hearing for a steep slope conditional use permit. This is on Park Avenue. It's going to be continued, but you'll hold the public hearing?
We'll hold the public hearing just to hear from the public, make sure everybody understands what's going on out there, and then we'll bring it back in 2 weeks.
All right. And then another item on the agenda is the Summit Watch Plaza.
Right. Summit Watch Plaza, the original plat for Summit Watch had some requirements for conditional uses inside the plaza for commercial use. And through four subsequent plats, that plat note or the note on the document continued that said we need a separate conditional use permit. That seemed on both sides, both us and the Owners Association, to be a little bit rigorous, given the nature of our need to kind of energize that public plaza. What we're going to do is we're going to take that note off the plat, or change the plat so that note goes away, and change the way we regulate that plaza more like we regulate Main Street. There will not be any vertical zoning in that section, but we're going to allow them to have some more uses without conditional use.
So what do you mean by there will not be any vertical
zoning? Vertical zoning happens in the HCB zone, which is Main Street, and then it extends down. And what it does is it regulates the uses that can be at street level. We're discussing in the planning department and with the planning commission not extending that vertical zoning through private plazas, which is the plaza that is on Marriott Summit Watch.
But and you are talking about extending it down Lower Main Street, right?
Or yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the entire, all the way to Heber Avenue. We're chatting about what we do with future uses on the Kimball and future uses on the Blue Iguana.
I was going to say all the way down to 9th Street, no?
Well, those are different kind of animals down there. They're inside of planned unit developments, which means they have a separate set of regulations. And I'm not really sure that additional regulation is going to be helpful down there. There's a bit of a dichotomy. I don't know how deeply you want to go into this today, but there's two things that serve our restaurants and shops on Main Street. One is tourism. Two are locals and the people that come out of offices. If we regulate too tightly on offices, we don't see those folks on Main Street. And we want that as well. So we're trying to find that balance.
All right. Also on the agenda, the National Ability Center looking for a conditional use permit. It sounds like it was for a shed, though, that's already been built?
Correct. They originally had asked for an administrative CUP for the Hay Storage Center because it could be a temporary building. And at the moment, they had an opportunity to get the shed built for free. And so in their nature of the kind of free,
nonprofit world.
Yeah, nonprofit world. Let's do it. So we went through the admin CUP process, and now they would like to hold on to it permanently to just have another space to run their programs better and be more organized.
Yeah. Can we talk just real briefly about, because it's recreation open space, right? I mean, with what was the given some certain parameters of what could be built there?
Under the recreation open space, an accessory building greater than 600 square feet would require the conditional use permit. So their building is 1,819 square feet, but it goes along with all the other conditional uses. It also will relate to their other storage barns, their riding arena, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Do they have approvals to put more building on their property or?
At the time they do, and it's more so that this use is not, it's more of a storage use, so it's not going to make their programs any bigger or bring any more people. So actually, they are going through a master plan development right now. They've submitted their pre-MPD, which Kirsten Whetstone is working on, but that will kind of include more things like dormitories and more space for encouraging their programs.
Okay. Hey, one other thing, Bruce, since you weren't sitting in this seat when this was decided, but certainly with the Kimball Art Center now sold and the new temporary art center nearly complete, I guess I'm just curious. I mean, if you had been in charge when those designs for those iconic art centers came forward, how would you have looked at them? I mean, would you have given them some leeway in order to keep the community art center on Main Street?
Well, that's a two-part question, so I'll answer the first one first, and that is I think there's a time and a place for icons. But when icons become egos in our historic districts, then I think we've got a problem. I don't have enough of the design review to take a look at the old design review eyes to take a look at what was originally proposed for the Kimball. But I think perhaps the public interest won out on that one. I do think we should be doing everything we can do from a planning standpoint to keep at least some of the functions of the Kimball Arts Center on Main Street or close to Main Street. And that's important for us. There's a couple of places where we're talking. It definitely needs to remain inside the city limits and probably should not go to Quinn's Junction for any reason. So the closer it is to the most number of people, the better.
So in terms of the application, I think, before the planning department for the old Kimball Arts Center, right, where do things stand with that?
Well, that one's been withdrawn. The applicant, or there's a potential new applicant, and we're discussing some early designs on that one. I don't believe they've made an application at this point yet.
Yeah. In terms of the givens, I mean, the old garage has to stay, and I guess it's a question of whether or not you can change it in a way that you add on top of it, or?
The old garage is a listed historic structure, and it's a landmark structure, and those are key terms. At this point, the garage itself has to stay and has to be remodeled or redeveloped in exactly the same way, like all of our other landmark significant sites. One of the questions that arose in the original proposal was whether they could go over the roof. And right now, the roof is a barrel roof like you see inside the No Name. And we're doing our best to make sure that that barrel roof remains visible to the public. In the historic preservation world, there's a couple ways that that can happen, so we're looking at that.
Yeah. What's another significant, historic significant building in town?
The museum, mm-hmm. the White Barn. I wish I'd have brought my historic team with me. They're better at it than I am.
Yeah, but we saw with like the museum, we did see an addition allowed the rear of the building, just not on top
That's
of
correct.
It.
That's correct. And the whistle stayed the same, and the front of the building mm-hmm. looks the same.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Well, I just wanted to go quickly. We are meeting tonight with the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission. Most of my team will have the night off, but I'll be there with Park City Planning Commission, and we're going to really work on transportation coordination and work on coordinating employee housing requirements. Both planning commissions are becoming quite aware of how much employee housing is required and when it needs to occur, and we want to make sure it's getting done on time and we're not moving projects before employee housing is constructed.
All right. Are those the only two things on the agenda then?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Bruce and McKenna, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
It's 8:31 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, coming up Thursday at the Joe Quinney Winter Sports Center at the Utah Olympic Park, four people, including three Park City residents, will be inducted into the Intermountain Ski Hall of Fame. In the studio with details, I have Connie Nelson. She's the president of the Alfangen Ski Museum, as well as one of the inductees, Dave Hanscom. We're hoping that Karen Huntu Miller will join us as well. So good morning and congratulations to you, Dave.
Thank you. Thank you, Leslie.
Thanks, Leslie.
Again, we mentioned Karen Huntu Miller, Dave Hanscom. Who are the two other inductees?
We've got Mel Dalebout and also Michi White.
Okay. And tell us how these four are selected or were selected.
Well, these four were selected due to their being ski pioneers. And in particular, Mel Dalebout was a ski sport innovator. And he, for those who have ever had his boots, know that he was the first inventor and innovator to develop the hard shell cased form-fitting ski boot, which is the Dale boot, and that is still operating today out of Ogden. And then we have Michi White, and most folks in town know Michi White, and she's en route from Mexico right now with her husband, and they'll be celebrating this Thursday with us. But Michi, of course, is a ski pioneer, and for those in town that know her, she co-founded in 1985 the National Ability Center. And, you know, that focuses on the physical and developmental disabilities, and in particular, the skiing up at Park City Mountain Resort was what she did with adaptive skiing was incredible, and being done throughout the world, actually. So, we're really pleased to have all four of these inductees to round out our Hall of Fame. With these four, we'll now have 66 honored in our Will and Jean Pickett Intermountain Ski Hall of Fame.
Mom, and as you mentioned, Mel was listed as an innovator. David's listed as inspirational. Karen as a competitor. Michi as a ski pioneer. Is that how you always do it? Try to pick one from some category, or
there were. It's a very competitive category. All of the categories, and the University of Utah J. Willard Library Ski Archives actually has a nomination committee that is very rigorous in looking at different aspects. And there's a lot of criteria that they have to meet to get into the Hall of Fame. And so these are just a few. But we also include Idaho, Wyoming, and Utah. So they do try to mix it up, but it's very competitive. And the four that we have here are very worthy. We're excited for Thursday. In fact, Leslie, we are sold out. We're going to be having the reception in the Alfangen Ski Museum on the first floor. We have a new exhibit to show everybody, and then we'll head upstairs into the tent. The tent is a little bit bigger than the theater, so we have approximately 235 guests, which I was expecting 160, but of course, Karen and Dave and Michi and Mel are so popular.
I know you have a lot of friends. Well, Karen, let me get you up to the microphone here. And, I mean, for someone born in the flats of Oklahoma, you went on to become the World Cup overall moguls champion back in 1975. So let's just talk a little bit about how the sports changed then. I mean, did you get a machine back then to build your bumps?
Oh, yeah. My knees.
Yeah.
No machines back then. We built our own bumps. Sometimes, like one time we went to Europe and they built them with shovels on top of hay bales because of no snow. But that was it.
Yeah.
No machines.
Right. I mean, because now it's like these perfect little mogul courses. Yeah. And it was like back then, it was like you just get what you just ski what you get, right?
Right.
Yeah.
No matter what it was.
Yeah. And talk a little bit about just the tricks that you had to do back. Because I think in terms of the competition, it's still similar, right? You have two kind of tricks in the middle?
No, it's different. Mm. Back when we started, if you went upside down in the moguls, you were disqualified. Now, if you don't go upside down, you don't even place. I mean, you got to almost go double upside down twice. You know, back then, it just, if you did a jump in the moguls, great, got extra points. I wasn't very good at that. I usually stayed on the ground.
So you didn't do like
the all the stuff. I was just a really fast mogul skier. Once in a while, if they were lucky, I might get a spread eagle in there, but not very often.
Yeah. So when you look back, I mean, how's your body holding up? I mean, skiing bumps has got to be one of the toughest things you would do to your knees and back.
You know, I never had any knee problems. I fell down once working in a job and broke my kneecap, but I never got hurt at all in the jumps. I mean, in the moguls or skiing.
Yeah. So how did you get into the sport?
My brother told me there was a new sport called freestyle and that I should go try it out because I was a good bump skier, or I was a good skier. And so he taught me 7 ballet tricks, taught me how to do a spread eagle off of a jump. And I went to Waterville Valley and tried it and thought, oh, what fun.
Yeah, I was going to say, no ski resorts, so in Oklahoma.
No, but I grew up in Vermont.
Ah.
I was born in Oklahoma, but I grew up in Vermont. I started skiing Killington when I was 4 years old. And I actually started skiing when I was 2 years old. So...
All right. So, I mean, that was what we used to call it. I mean, it's still freestyle, but we had what? Moguls, ballet,
aerials, and ballet.
LA.
Yeah. And it's changed a lot. I mean, it's a totally different sport now.
Yeah.
It's just really different. I mean, we might have helped get it where it is, but we didn't do it the same way it's being done now.
Yeah. And you did it for quite a while.
I did. You know what? They paid me to go skiing. And I traveled the world, and I met great people, and I had a great time.
Yeah. Well, again, congratulations. David, tell us a little bit about your history. I mean, we know we can find you at every local Nordic ski competition.
I was just thinking I'd be great in the moguls. I'm upside down quite a lot. My history, I was a Nordic skier in college. Came out here after grad school and got involved in backcountry skiing. Helped write the Wasatch Tours cross-country ski guide. In more recent years, like the last 20 or 25, I've been more track skier and helped out with the local races and Olympics and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So how was your career in college? I mean, were you a good competitor back then? Or?
Well, I won the Eastern cross-country and Nordic combined 1 year, so that's about my only claim to fame. But never went beyond that, not an Olympic skier like Karen.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, that book, Wasatch Tours, it's been a while since I've seen a copy of that. I'm guessing it's still one of the best books on the subject. Do those ski tours, though, still exist, or have chairlifts kind of wiped
them out?
Yeah,
it's kind of sad. We had a first edition in 1976. And then we came out with a second edition, a 3-volume edition in early 90s, and probably half of the beginner tours from the first edition were gone by the time we did the second edition because ski areas had expanded. And now even some of those are gone as that continues.
Yeah. So, I mean, plans to do a third one?
No, we're done.
Yeah.
It was fun, but it's time to not do that sort of thing again. We keep expecting someone else to come out with a modern version, but they haven't.
Well, now it's all about keeping them secret, right?
Yeah.
Because that invites you and everybody else.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, you were instrumental in the selection of Soldier Hollow as a site for the cross-country venues during the 2002 Olympics. I mean, kind of given the warmer winters we've seen, and would you wish you would have found a place closer to Park City, looking back?
Unfortunately, the international FIS has rules about elevation, and so Soldier Hollow is pretty much the maximum elevation. We pushed really hard for Mountain Dell to be selected, but for various reasons it didn't work out, so I was on a committee that traveled up and down the Wasatch looking for a good site. Soldier Hollow seemed to be the best, and I think it was, I mean, definitely was the right choice.
Yeah, and I was going to say, because Round Valley probably too small and
too high.
Yeah. And then also you've been certainly instrumental with the Wasatch Citizen Series. I mean, considered one of the best organized, you know, cross-country races going.
Yeah, that's been a lot of fun. I've been involved in that for 20 years or so, and as the director before that, I helped out a little bit in getting the thing going, but it's been a good series, and we've had a lot of support from sponsors and local racers.
Yeah. Well, again, congratulations to both of you. That's quite an honor. Anything else you wanted to add, Connie?
No, just come up to Utah Olympic Park and to the Alphing and Ski Museum. Their plaques will be enshrined into the Hall of Fame, and from Thursday on, congratulations.
Yeah, aren't you glad they chose those photos of you?
People chose their own photos.
Oh, they're like in the height of your, right? I mean, back when you were like, this was probably in the 80s or mid-70s, then, Karen.
Yeah, I'd say 70s.
And Dave, you're with your old wood skis there?
Yeah, well, that's the real Dave Hanscom. So
there you go.
I figured I didn't want any modern pictures.
Yeah, that's
the
felt
old
the
guy.
Same way. Felt the same way.
That's awesome. All right. Hey, well, thanks for coming by this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you, Leslie.
It's 8:42 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. This is the Local News Hour on KPCW. The Swanner Eco Center has a number of upcoming events. In the studio with details, the director of the Swanner Eco Center, as well as co-host of This Green Earth, Nell Larson. Good morning, Nell.
Good morning, Leslie.
So first up, it's all about beavers?
That's right, yeah. Beavers are a hot topic in our town, which we judge by the number of calls and questions that we get about them every year, which is huge. So we asked Joe Wheaton, who's a professor at Utah State University, to come down and do a talk about kind of the pros and cons and challenges of kind of living in an ecosystem with beavers.
Okay, so when's that happening?
So that is happening next week. It'll be September 24th. And
actually, that's Thursday.
Joe will do, oh my gosh. Joe, you're right. Joe will do his talk, and he'll talk kind of about the dynamics and actually how beavers build the structures they build and how they impact the ecosystems. And then after the talk, everyone will have the opportunity to do some hands-on activities. This is part of what we call the Science Unwrapped series. And so the group will actually build a large kind of man-made mock beaver dam. And it's open to families, adults, and kids, and should be a really fun one. It is from 6:30 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. $5 per person are free for members, as usual. And just, of course, please remember to register, which you can do from our website.
All right. Now, so do you have beaver dams on the preserve?
We do, and this has been an interesting one for us to watch. About 9-10 years ago, we had a lot of beaver activity, and then for whatever reason, these beavers were trapped out up and downstream. They moved to other areas. We didn't see a ton of activity for several years. And then over the past couple of years, we've seen them come back in and actually manage to build a significant dam across East Canyon Creek, which is like no small task, in addition to some of the smaller creeks. And the dams do great things for water quality. They can help to cool water downstream of the dam. They increase biodiversity. And they also help the water to infiltrate in the soil around the beaver pond.
Yeah. But the nuisance is that they chop down all of the nearby trees.
Yeah, exactly. So those downsides, they'll chop down nearby trees, you know, they'll head up into people's gardens and landscaping to do that if it's close enough to a stream within like 100 feet or so. And they can also cause problematic flooding, you know, if a road or a yard or a house was built in an area near a stream, not expecting that level to pop up 18 inches, it can definitely cause some problems. So those are things that we've encountered too.
Yeah, so do you keep them or do you, I mean, at what point do you have to say sorry, beaver?
So that's, you know, a decision that's made on an individual basis. On the nature preserve, it's something that we love to see happening. So we wouldn't trap them out because of activity we were seeing. However, if you know, I know, like, for example, in one of the neighborhoods upstream, there was some pretty serious flooding. It was putting a house in danger, and they made the decision to trap that beaver out and relocate. And that's, you know, it's not an easy one. Beavers don't have a great success rate when they relocate. But obviously, you know, there comes a point where people need to make that call.
Yep. There's more than one beaver per dam, though, aren't there?
Yeah.
Like a family?
Yes. There's actually a group usually with each dam, and they'll often build a series of dams. So it's not just one single one. But what we also try to encourage is alternative solutions. There are some different kinds of beaver pond levelers, different ways you can sort of trick the beavers into letting some water through a dam structure. And, you know, options besides trapping the beaver or ripping down the dam.
All right. You also have an upcoming film screening. What's that about?
That's right. So this is a film screening that we're doing in conjunction with Park City Municipal Sustainability and also the Park City Film Series. And the film is called Project Wild Thing. And it's a film that is lighthearted and funny and kind of highlights the difficulties of getting children outside. The filmmaker uses his own family as the example. And so you see a lot of him and his kids, but he also sort of brings into play the larger situation, the larger challenge in this area. And it's something that all three of our organizations kind of thought is something that we need to think about, even in this community where kids, most kids, have a lot of opportunity to get outside. Many of us, adults and kids alike, don't spend the time in the outdoors that we should.
All right. So when's that happening?
So that is on October 1st, another Thursday. And that one is coming up 7 p.m. The cost for that one is free. And for this event, we're not requiring registration. And it's at the Jim Santee Auditorium, so there's plenty of seating. The capacity is about 450 seats, so you don't need to worry about registering for that one. We just want people to come and enjoy, and then everyone will have a chance to make their own pledge to get outside, whether that's a half hour a day or to match their screen time with their outdoor time or whatever it is that works for you.
All right. And then also you've got a conversation with Brian Richter. He's with the Nature Conservancy. And
yeah.
He's coming when?
Yeah. So Brian Richter actually runs the water program for the Nature Conservancy. He's their chief scientist for the water program. And he's also the president of Sustainable Waters, a water education group. And so he is coming into town from Virginia to speak about his experience in water science and conservation and, you know, what the future of water might look like in the West. And so that's toward the end of October on the 27th from 6 to 8 p.m. And as most of our events are, $5 or free for members, and you can register online.
All right. I just wanted to touch bases with you. I mean, you had some concerns a year ago when we saw the Canyons Golf Course coming online. Did you see any impacts of not enough water as a result of that?
Well, it's hard to, you know, tag it to any one thing, of course, but we did see very low flows, and there was definitely concern throughout the spring and summer that it would dry up, but we got just enough rain, just enough moisture to kind of keep things flowing. And the rain that we've had over the past couple of weeks has been a real gift to East Canyon Creek. We've seen some of the smaller streams dry up that come down through sort of the periphery of the nature preserve and generally would flow through. We've seen some of those drying up before they kind of come into the preserve. But East Canyon Creek has maintained enough flow.
Yeah. So what are some of our options, though, to ensure that you maintain those flows?
Yeah.
I mean, it's downhill water rights.
Yeah.
But, right? I mean,
yeah, exactly. Water rights are kind of the only option. And private groups and individuals are not legally allowed to hold water rights for in-stream flow. And so it involves kind of working with those larger state entities the, you know, state water engineer and DWR, who can hold water rights for in-stream flow, to try to make that happen. We're also working really closely with the East Canyon Watershed Committee and the Weber Basin Water Conservancy District, because Weber Basin has the ability to sort of work with intake points, so where those straws are being put in the stream. And those are opportunities that we're hoping to work on in the next couple of years.
Yeah, and I know the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District has for years tried to see some legislation pass, but it's just, I mean, is it too big of a lobby or?
I think that it's a really, you know, ingrained system in Utah. It's been here since the beginning, and even though it's kind of funky and it's not working well for us anymore, the water rights system, you know, has been in place since the mid-1800s, and so the folks that have those oldest water rights don't want to let those go, understandably. But in our basin, the water rights were allocated when there was more precipitation than we've seen recently, so they're actually over-allocated. There's more water that's been distributed than there is water in the stream to give. So it's a tough issue, and I think it will be a slow-moving one, but we'll stick with it.
All right. Hey, Nell, anything else?
I wanted to mention two of our programs are starting up for the fall that run during the school year. One of those is the Eco Club, and that's a new program for us for middle schoolers, and it's kind of an environment service-based group. The kids get to choose and help direct what the group does, and then they also work with one of our educators on learning about nature and our local environment. That means twice a month and is free, and I think we have three spots left in that club, so if you have a middle schooler that's interested and wants some service, you can email us to join. And then our Little Naturalist reading program for 3 to 5 year olds also starts up with the beginning of the school year. And each week that the program takes place, they'll read two books and then do an activity or a craft to go with each of those.
Okay, Nell, thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
Nell Swanner is, Larson is the executive director of the Swanner Eco Center. Well, Slow Food Park City presents its annual food and film weekend. It's this weekend, and in the studio with details, I have the president of Slow Food Park City, Nate Vineyard. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So start off and just tell us what Slow Food Park City is.
You know, I thought you might ask that question, mm-hmm. So I came prepared, and I've finished this book called The Blue Zones. And if you haven't heard about it, it's a really interesting book about longevity. And the author goes to, I think, 4 or 5 different areas in the world and tries to find the secret sauce to why people are living so well above their 100, well into their 100s. And he found a disturbing trend is that he went to Okinawa and he found that the American food culture came in, and one of the blue zones is actually starting to have mortality rates that are lower than the Japanese. And I just, if I can read this real quick, he said, he told me that the Okinawan culture of longevity was beginning to disappear with the encroaching American food culture. Kentucky Fried Chicken and McDonald's were the last calamity to befall Okinawa. Men under 55 in Okinawa are now among the most obese and do not live much longer than the Japanese average. Anyway, so Slow Food Park City is all about creating an alternative to this American food culture that is a paradox. It has a lot of progress and efficiency, but at the same time, there's some unintended consequences. And you know, slow food is about increasing the quality of food and the long and our experience with it, really.
Okay, so you do this every year, work with Park City Film Series to produce this weekend of film and food. You've got 3 different nights, 3 different films. We should note that it's special start times, Friday and Saturday nights at 7 as opposed to 8 o'clock. So on Friday, you've got 1 screening, 2 dinners at Good Karma. Tell us what's going to happen on Friday night.
Well, Friday night is the screening of the film, The 100-Foot Journey, and it was produced by Steven Spielberg and Oprah Winfrey. And it's a really delicious film about an Indian family that goes to France and opens up shop. And so after we're pairing that with Good Karma, we wanted just to thank Good Karma for all the community support. And so they're offering us a 3-course meal at a discounted price, and it's going to be delicious. The chef of Good Karma will be there after the film to kind of share his garlic naan and some spices.
All right. So the dinners are at what, 5 and 9 p.m.?
So, yeah, we offer, you know, there's two different times in case it's too late for you or for anybody. They can come in and go to the restaurant first and then go to the film, or they can, vice versa.
Okay. And then the film again at 7 o'clock right in the middle. Tickets are how much?
With the restaurant pairing, it's $46. And usually the three-course meal at Karma is $55. So that includes your ticket. And we really thank Good Karma for helping us out that way.
All right. And then on Saturday, we're going to do film and wine. Tell us about this.
Well, this may be one of the best events in the fall, if you don't mind me saying it. It's Bella Vita is about an Italian surfer who goes back to Italy to kind of rediscover his heritage. And it's just rich in visual arts and also food and culture. And a really wonderful thing is that we'll be offering a wine pairing with it. Excuse me, a pre-tasting. It's before the film, will be a tasting. And it's from a 112-year-old Tuscan estate with 100% certified organic wines, with an addition just made for this film.
Oh, so who, the winemaker made, they worked together then, the filmmaker and the winemaker?
Yeah, I think the director, they're actually related. And this is a Zio Baffa wine from, and it's a filmmaker's edition, Bella Vita Harvest, Estate of Harvest.
All right, so I saw the trailer, so there's been some great surfing shots in there as well.
It's beautiful, it's a beautiful film. I'm really looking forward to it.
All right, and the tickets for this are how much?
$30 includes the three glasses of wine.
And the film ticket. Okay. Yeah. And again, screening starts at 7, so you're asking people to gather what time for the wine tasting?
You know, probably half an hour, maybe, tops.
Okay. And then on Sunday, a bake sale.
Yeah, this is our traditional bake sale. Please think about bringing something to share with the community. And then it's a fundraiser for Slow Food. And then it's a really kind of, you know, old-fashioned kind of bake sale, really fun, really low-key. But Deer Valley is stepping up, and they'll be having some pastries there, so thanks to Deer Valley.
All right. I mean, can you bring full cakes, or do you want pieces of cake?
Probably slices, mm-hmm. But we'll take full, whatever you got.
Okay. And then again, all the money raised will go to benefit the group?
Yeah, Slow Food Park City. And before we get done, I just wanted to thank Katie Wing. She was an unbelievable help. And none of this would happen without her. So thank you, Katie.
So what's the film on Sunday?
This one is called Food for Change. And it's about the approach to buying food. And we'll have two panelists after the film. And they'll be discussing food co-op, maybe here in, even in Park City.
Okay. All right. People want more information. Do you have a website?
Slowfoodparkcity.org. Just go right there. You'll see that big poster. And we have tickets there. We'd love to see you.
Okay, can you get everything online then? Tickets or?
Yeah, it's a quick link to Park City Film Series. There are tickets there. They're kind of managing that for us.
Okay. Hey, Nate, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:59.
Morning News and the Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher is provided by Park City Medical Center, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Deer Valley Resort, and Promontory and the Promontory Foundation.